Hey, guess what? The .NET Developer Days conference is happening October 18th and 19th in Warsaw, with some great speakers and over 30 technical sessions spread over 2 days. Among them are keynotes by Scott Hunter and James Montemagno. If you can't make it to Warsaw in person, they also offer a great online option. For only 150 euros, you can access 2 days of live-streamed conference sessions, as well as all the session recordings after the show. Check them out at developerdays.pl and take 20% off your online registration with the code ROCKS. That's R-O-C-K-S exclamation point. Hey, welcome back to .NET Rocks. This is Carl Franklin.
And this is Richard Campbell.
And we're, again, recording live on Bullhorn. If you don't know what that is, go to bullhorn.fm/.NET Rocks and follow us there. And if you do that, when we go live, you can participate.
Yeah. We got a bunch of folks here. But John's immediately complaining. It's like, I normally listen at like 1.25 times. And so you guys are talking slow.
You sound stoned.
Yeah, no, the downside to live is it's literally one times. There's no other way to do it.
There's no other way to cheat time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how you doing, Mr. Campbell?
I'm all right. You know, we're recording these shows at the beginning of September for publication later, because publication earlier is really, really hard.
Yeah.
And tomorrow I leave for Australia.
All right.
And the wife's coming with. I am officiating the wedding of Troy Hunt and Charlotte.
That is so cool.
Yeah, very excited to do that.
I keep thinking maybe they, because they had a long engagement, but I keep thinking they've been married like 7 times now.
Yeah. I think Charlotte came down for a visit and then the lockdowns happened in Australia and she literally couldn't leave.
Wow.
So, yeah, they kind of dove into the deep end there.
They did.
They're very happy. I've spent some time with them in June and we've worked on a nice set of vows. We've got the kids involved and I'm really excited to get it done and have the experience. And
Troy will say, I promise not to pwn you.
Yeah, something like that. You know, he's also just put out his book, plugging for a friend here, a book called Pwned.
Wow.
And I got the privilege to write one of the forewords to it as well. And
fantastic.
It is a collection of his blog posts, curated by our friend Rob Connery.
Nice.
Being published by Big Machine. And it's a great story. It's phenomenal and really a fascinating time.
I can't wait to read it.
Yeah.
So that brings us squarely to the part of the show we call Better Know a Framework. Roll the crazy music.
All right, buddy. What do you got?
Well, I want to do a shout out for one of our sister shows. This is my YouTube show called The .NET Show.
Ah. What an innovative name you have.
I know.
There.
I don't know. It just came to me. Yeah, it's all video, YouTube video right now. I'm focused on Maui, but I've done some more general stuff.
Right.
And the last three episodes, 24, 25, and 26, are what I want to draw your attention to.
Mm-hmm.
Because I've been waiting for a really good updated way to do authentication in a Maui app.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. And there was this thing, and there still is, in the Xamarin space called the Web Authenticator.
Mm-hmm.
And now there's MSAL.net. MSAL is the Microsoft Authentication Library, and they have a .NET version. So I figured out, along with some friends of mine, how to make a secure API in Azure and then use Azure AD B2C to authenticate against your Microsoft account. That was episode 24. Get a token and then call the API with that token.
Nice.
And then the next episode, 25, we brought Twitter into the mix. Hmm. So now you can use your Twitter account to authenticate. And also in that episode, we allowed you to create an account in your Azure AD B2C with your email address and password. So that's cool. So if you don't want to use Twitter or Microsoft, you can just create an account in your Azure AD B2C, in my Azure AD B2C, And it's seamless, and you never have to know who those people are, except when you go to your users tab in Azure, and you can manage them there. It's really cool. And then episode 26, which just dropped September 7th, is Google. So we added Google as an identity provider.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been waiting for all this stuff because I, you know, first of all, it's a void. You know, there are the information is out there on the internet, but getting it all together in a succinct demo is not there. And so we pulled together all the resources and, you know, fixed all the weirdnesses and all of that and exposed the tweaks and things you have to do. Mm-hmm. So I just wanted to point that out. And now that I have this, I'm going to be developing a new Music to Flow By app for Music to Flow By. And yes, I know this is .NET Rocks, so you're used to hearing Music to Code By, and that's fine.
Right.
You can still get that library and download it and all of that. But Music to Flow By is just a rebranded version of that, and it's for everybody. You know, it's nice. The same music, though. It's the same stuff.
Yeah. You know, you'll know it.
But it's rebranded for non-developers.
Just to not exclude folks.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, everybody needs a flow. There's lots of different reasons to flow.
Right, but not everybody codes.
That's true. Now, you know, the wife's been heavily immersed in the 3D side of clothing technology recently. A bunch of new breakthroughs. And I routinely go and buy her office, see her in exactly the same kind of focus. You know, taking a pattern and stitching it around an avatar and all of the details of that. It's the same mindset. It just doesn't happen to be a programming language.
Right.
Awesome.
Yeah. So that's it. Know it, learn it, love it. And be on the lookout for the Music to Flow By app, which will be a new and upcoming at some point.
Great.
Yeah. So who's talking to us, Richard?
Grabbed a comment off of show 1702 we did back in August of 2020, where we talked about AWS and .NET apps, specifically serverless, with Rob Schieffer. And kind of a bunch of comments on that show back in the day. This particular one from Richard Rakima caught my eye, because it's really sort of a conversation about the differences between AWS and Azure, where Richard said, I love the discussion, but Azure has hands down the best for creating a new paradigm of applications built for platform as a service, which can totally disrupt verticals that are so ingrained in the sort of server and data center mentality. Azure is a cloud service provider, where AWS is a cloud data center provider, which I don't know, Richard. You know, you can do the same thing in both. It's just different approaches. He goes on to say, most businesses still rely on their IT operations to guide them on their application deployment needs. True. And that mindset has been difficult to shift in the past 20 years. And once a business understands that applications can be built on services, they'll never look back. The problem we had today is that most, if not all, of enterprise applications were built on the server mentality and has hence have dependencies on where that application is living. Now, that is what being a cloud app really is you don't care about that anymore. Yeah. And he wraps up by saying, Docker is a good place to start for an application, but really it also needs to be not defined on a cluster that's living within it. An application that can leverage dynamic scale really doesn't have any practical boundaries in terms of the resources it can use. And that can include managing traffic to Azure and all data centers it has available. The only real issue is not the load, but the monetization that follows around that type of demand. In other words, how much it costs, I think it's challenging for folks to think in terms of what if you had an unlimited amount of compute? How do you build an architecture that can tolerate it? And Richard's a regular listener. We've talked to him before and certainly appreciate his input. And a copy of Music to Code By is on its way to him. And if you'd like a copy of Music to Code By, write a comment on the website at .NETRocks.com or on the Facebooks. We publish every show there. And if you comment there and I read it on the show, we'll send you a copy of Music to Code By.
And definitely send us a tweet. Or the shorthand version is just a tweet. Yeah. He's at Rich Campbell. I'm at Carl Franklin.
Really?
Yeah. It's, you know, that's my go-to.
Is that Rockin' Robin? Is that where you went?
That's Rockin' Robin, yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Michael Jackson.
Jackson 5. I don't think that's the original, but I think he...
No. I like their version. Yeah. The J5. So...
All right.
I guess it's time to introduce our guest. Isaac Levin is a .NET developer advocate at Amazon Web Services, as well as a Microsoft MVP. He has over 10 years of experience working as a developer for the web, mostly in the Microsoft ecosystem. Outside of work, he hosts a podcast called Coffee and Open Source, where he interviews folks from across the tech industry as well as builds open source projects like Presence Lite and GitHub Stat Tracker. He lives outside of Seattle, Washington, and likes to wind down from work with his wife, Ariana, and his two sons, Isaac and Avery. Welcome, Isaac.
Thank you for having me. I am quite excited to be here.
Happy to have you back, man.
Yep.
Yeah. For folks who might not know, I've been on Runners Radio as well, and that was a great conversation. It almost seems like an eternity ago.
For sure. Yeah. No, we talked about all sorts of things. Well, and we're in the same conference circles, like we see each other here, there, and everywhere.
Before we get started, did I tell you that I got the old feed working with tags?
Nice. No, that's good news.
Yeah. So your old, pop.com feed ASPX show name or show equals .NET Rocks and tags equals whatever works.
That works.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's it.
That's cool.
I guess that could have been my better known framework, but
could have whatever. Been, but there's nothing wrong with the .NET show either.
So, Isaac, I did a little stint with AWS trying to get a Blazor application working, and it was the little things that tripped me up. Like, for example, you can't have a website unless you have HTTPS, right? And you can't really have HTTPS unless you have a domain certificate and you apply that and all that. And I'm used to Azure, where it's just like, push a couple of buttons, get a free managed certificate, boom, 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 yada, yada. And it just seemed like, I had to go through all the old hoops that I had to before to get a certificate in AWS. And that's kind of where my experience ends. AWS,
Sure. How long ago was that?
That was a good 2 or 3 years ago. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, because now there's an AWS service called AWS Certificate Manager, which kind of does something probably what you're looking for.
Good.
I don't know when that was released, but I think one of the things that we're seeing more and more prevalent in the web space, specifically in .NET, is like HTTP. You have to work very, very hard to just get HTTP, right? Which I think for most scenarios is really ideal, right? Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's very interesting about AWS specifically is there are tons and tons of services. And most of these services, they serve all sorts of purposes. And I think one of the things that's really important to talk about from a .NET developer's perspective is, hey, this service that you might not know about, you could definitely take advantage of and use, right? Mm. Whether it's an option for hosting, whether it's some data source platform that you want to take advantage of, or some silly bells and whistles like AI and ML, right? Like, I think that it's almost impossible to stay up to date with all of them. But I think there's a few that I think people definitely should be aware of. And, look, if they're looking to use AWS, build apps that use them.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. They have reflexes around certain things and they got to understand the differences. I do want to loop back a bit to Richard's comment too, because it does strike me that AWS tends to just build the core plumbing, and then there are service providers for a lot of the services that sit on top of it. And it doesn't seem like it approaches the same way that Azure does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think one of the things, especially with AWS, that I think initially might be a bit different for folks is just the mindset around building apps on AWS, right? Like, I think one of the things that's very, very interesting about AWS specifically is they use this least privilege, access approach, right? For instance, if you're trying to build an application, everything is policy based as it pertains to access. So like, I want this app to be able to access this database and so on and so forth. Like, there isn't a lot of dependency on things like connection strings or tokens and things like that, because it's done inside the AWS infrastructure. Richard was his name, right?
Yeah, Richard Rakima.
Yeah. So one of the things that I thought was interesting about what they said is that, AWS is kind of a data center versus, whatever they called Azure. I mean, I think, at least from my experience, there are tons of services that people can take advantage of that are not just data center like experiences for, especially for .NET developers, right? Like for instance, like AWS Amplify, right? For folks who don't know about AWS Amplify, it's a Jamstack service, basically similar to like you would think of like Azure Static Web Apps or something like that, right? Where you have a front end and you have a back end and you can deploy something like WebAssembly Blazor, right? Like that is the antithesis of just like a VM, right? I think in general, like there's this huge coverage of the different kinds of services that exist in AWS, specifically for what a customer is trying to accomplish, right? Like you have like the EC2, like give me a VM, give me IIS and let me party that story. Yeah. You have maybe like a managed version of IIS or a managed environment that you can deploy to. And then you have from there, you have going obfuscation away from Windows, away from Linux, all the way to
not so much obfuscation as abstraction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a better word.
But it gets to this idea that virtual machines are sort of the lesser cousin here. This is the basic way to get into cloud. But if you really want to get to cloud architectures, you're getting higher and higher up the platform where you don't care about the operating system. You don't care about the runtime space. Like all of those things are abstracted from you because you shouldn't deal with it. It's plumbing. Pay for it by the minute.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if you're a .NET framework developer, for instance, you know, you might have, hey, I need to do things that are in Windows. And maybe you need to be able to tweak things like the registry or whatever inside of a VM. And that's a totally valid point. But if you're on .NET 6, for instance, like I have a very, very, it's interesting having a conversation with folks like, do you really need Windows at all? Like if you need Windows, I'd love to understand why you need Windows. So I think, you know, one of the things that's very, very interesting about that whole approach is that you see folks going from a dependency on Windows to just being able to write .NET apps anywhere.
Right.
Right. So like being able, and again, that's just at the operating system level. Maybe I don't care about the operating system at all.
No. Well, and I'm finding even with folks that are running inside of Azure is they're using .NET Core and running on Linux because it's cheaper, full stop.
Sure. Mm. Sure. Yeah. I mean, it just goes back to the point, like, do you need to do all the stuff? Do you need a patch?
Right.
Do you need to worry about all of those things? Just give me some sort of environment where I can just run a block of code and go about my merry way.
There is one thing that has always kept me away from using, say, a Chromebook, and that is support for USB drivers. Like, I can't connect an audio device and have it recognize, you know. I can't connect my devices. They have to be specific for the OS, and Chrome OS doesn't support USB.
Yeah, my kid has a Chromebook, and I think one of the first things that I realized is that it's basically it is Chrome OS, so it needs the internet, it needs these things. But the fact that you're saying like I can't put in any external devices into it, the expectation is I just use this for the browser,
right?
And maybe a couple of apps.
Yeah. I mean, you can, but it's a very limited set.
Yeah.
Right. Like I use a USB based, FIDO key to access my Chrome, my security on my Chrome slate. Like they do work, but you're used to Windows where everything runs, right? Where that's the first driver you make.
But there's a user story right there for why you need an OS. Mm-hmm. You know,
well, and you've always have an OS. It's just what is the OS that does the things you need it to do.
Right.
But we were talking kind of, you know, in cloud, we're talking server-side stuff.
Sure.
And more, the OS is really quite irrelevant.
It is, yeah. Right?
Especially, yeah. And then throw in the fact that .NET doesn't care. If you've made it over to 5, 6, now 7, if you're still on 4.8, you know, you're still dealing with, no, this has to run in Windows.
Yeah, and that's like some of the, like, at least from in my world, one of the things we're really, really trying to accomplish is getting folks aware of .NET 6, our customers, right? And if you're on .NET Framework, for instance, you know, the conversation of, okay, well, if I'm on .NET Framework 3.5, like getting to 4.8 is almost impossible. And then getting from 4.8 to .NET 6 is another somewhat impossible step, depending on how elaborate your applications are.
Yeah.
But there are tools out there that can help you prepare to have that conversation. Like one of the tools that I think is really cool is the porting assistant for .NET that AWS built. And basically what it does is it generates like a really rich assessment of your .NET Framework applications and provides a list of things that will need to change going from .NET Framework to .NET 6. And, you know, that supports, you know, most of the primary, like web-based project types, including WCF. It'll look to port your apps to WCF core, which I think is pretty cool. It'll primitively look at web forms and port them to Blazor. So nice. I think that there's some interesting things there.
Yeah, no, and I think that's the big thing is you want that crib sheet, right? You need that additional help just to try to figure out what pieces are where and how those things, each of them work.
Yeah.
Is there a website somewhere that says, hey, if you're used to doing this with app service, here's how it works on AWS?
Yeah. Hmm. So there is a page on Microsoft Docs going the other way. So like if you are an AWS customer, this is the service that you would probably use in Azure. We're actually in the process of building a similar crib sheet of sorts. Because we understand that customers might like to see some sort of comparison between features, but at the end of the day, I am not in the world of comparing and contrasting all the clouds. Cause I think for the most part, I want to get people on-prem to the cloud. Right. So because I think at the end of the day, that's where, like if you want to talk about cloud A versus cloud B, we can have that conversation, but it's all going to boil down to probably two things for a customer: cost and feature banana. Right.
Right.
So like if those two things match that particular goal of that customer, they'll go forward with that cloud, or they might go hybrid or whatever.
Well, and I think and for the average project, all of these clouds can do this. Like we could throw GCP into the mix. It's just a question of what do you need to learn to do it?
Exactly. Right. And, you know, the ecosystem, I think, is the most challenging thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like if you're familiar with one cloud and you go to another cloud, you're like, oh, my brain doesn't work like this. Let me think about it a different way.
There's a bunch of assumptions you have that are now incorrect.
Yeah. You know, especially like for all those things kind of on the edge. Like I think for the most part, like a VM is a VM no matter where it is. Or for the most part, a managed service is a managed service or a serverless function like Lambda or App Service or CoRunner or whatever.
They are different. Like you can't just move between them.
Of course.
If you understand one, you can learn the other pretty easily. The principles are the same.
Yeah. I guess my point was going to be like there's these other things too, like identity. Or access, or like those are the things where, or infrastructure, or like infrastructure provisioning. Like these are some of the things that, okay, why is this different than this? Right. Like, and when you start thinking about things like infrastructure as code, like then there's tools that aren't cloud based, things like Terraform, things like Pulumi, things like whatever. Right.
Right.
So and then you have to throw all that stuff into the mix as well. So I always like to say being a developer, you have it. An uncomfortable amount of options to do things.
Yes. Mm. There are entirely too many ways.
Yeah.
Indeed.
And every single way is right, depending on who you ask.
Yeah. Except, of course, the greatest fear is getting 80% of the way through a right way and hitting a wall that's like, oh, maybe I have done this the wrong way.
Mm. Sure. Yeah. I think one of the big things that I stress when I talk to customers is, like, what problem are you trying to solve? Because at the end of the day, like, you know, there's a conversation about containerization or whatever, you know, the question that you pulled. Containers are great. But if you know nothing about containers, like, you're going to have to learn about containers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right? It is definitely a hoop to jump through to get good with containers.
Yeah. But I think at the end of the day, especially if you're looking to optimize cost and performance in these things, containerization is definitely a path that people should be looking. And again, like when it comes to tools, like AWS has this tool called App2Container, which will actually take a .NET app framework or .NET Core 3.1 or .NET 6 or whatever and containerize it for you and build you your Docker file and get you in a place where you can deploy it to like Elastic Container Service on AWS, right?
Well, and this, you know, getting back to your mission here, which is I have a group of folks that are not on the cloud, have apps that are not on the cloud, and there probably are .NET 4.8. And, you know, the CTO is saying, hey, we need to get this into the cloud. I don't want to buy another set of hardware to run it. Let's go get to the monthly charge. And you're looking at what do I got to do to migrate this app up there? Like, is a service like apt-to-container a useful approach for that? Because I got to think a .NET app, a 4.8 app running in a container is tricky.
Yeah. Yeah. So one of the things, funny enough, since I started working at AWS is there are a lot of customers that want to run Windows containers. Like they want to run a .NET framework. They just need to get off of their own ecosystem. They need to get off of their on-premise environment, their co-locate space, whatever. And they can't make that jump. Maybe they're on 4.8 and then we just can't make that jump right now from .NET framework to .NET 6. But we want to be in the cloud. And we don't think that just taking our VM and putting it in the cloud is a sustainable model for us. So what can we do in this space? Well, you can use something like apt-to-container. So apt-to-container is actually, it's a command line utility. You can look at the code on GitHub. And it basically, what it does is it will take your application, it'll do an assessment of it, and then it will start to put together the building blocks needed to deploy it to Elastic Container Service, which is our container platform, or EKS, which is our Kubernetes platform.
Right.
And then that's a whole nother conversation if you start going down the path of containerization.
And one I hope we have because it is another confusing part of this whole equation.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And even if you like, if you want to go even further down that path from like a modernization standpoint and you want to use Kubernetes, like we also have a tool called the Microservice Extractor, which will take a look at your application, .NET framework or .NET 6, and start to identify how you can break it up into your monolith application into microservices. And then it'll build, again, that process, Docker files, all that to deploy to EKS.
That's the key, isn't it?
Yeah. And these are tools that are just available, right? Like it's, I think, you know, from a modernization standpoint, we understand that being on-prem is not sustainable for a long time. Because especially if you want to scale, like I joke, at some point, like you run out of space in your basement, right? If you're an office, all right, and you just your bottom floor is all a data center, you'll run out of space at some point, or you'll run out of money buying hardware. So getting it to the cloud in any way possible is ideal. Like, and if depending on what your interest is, I guess you could say, porting is an option, containerization is an option, or monolith to microservice is an option.
A dump run is an option for my basement anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. I used to work at a help desk when I was in college, and like we had this room of all of these old Dell Optiplexes, right? And the question I was like, what do we do with them? And because you couldn't donate them for some particular reason, I don't know what the reason was. And the guy who ran the help desk, because they will sit there forever. I'm like, okay, that sounds like not a good
ominous
idea.
Yeah,
right.
Very just, ominous.
You know, yeah. And you know, you both have worked with guys from the help desk. Like that's kind of their style.
I've been the guy from the help desk.
Yeah, like, exactly.
It's one of the most humbling jobs, but I've also, you know, been the manager who could help construct a help desk because it was the best training ground for staff in the company. Like if you really want to understand a product and you want to be a developer, let's have you do a year on the help desk first. Like now you're going to come into development with a mindset of here's how people use the app and where they're frustrated.
Yeah. I started in tech support in a small programming company, and that's
legit.
That was totally a great experience.
Well, I think that the whole thing, at least from my experience working in that sort of customer facing customer support world, is that you build like this level of empathy, which I think is really, really important for developers to have. I think, you know, we're all guilty as developers of just assuming everybody knows our language and like, oh, like you're running into this bug. Like no user will ever hit this bug. Well, that's not true.
You are incorrect.
Exactly. So if you have that level of customer empathy or user empathy, it'll help you leaps and strides, right? Of, you know, being able to build effective software. I saw something that was kind of interesting in the chat about like AWS Linux, right? And WSL2. Like one thing to call out that's kind of interesting is that like AWS has like their own flavor of Linux. We have, so it's not as simple as, oh, it's like Ubuntu this or that.
Right.
And we're looking to make that option is robust as possible, right? Because we understand that there are some things that people want access to that they might not want from a Fedora or an Ubuntu or whatever, sure. right? So it's just an interesting thought as well.
And you have an opportunity to make a build that's optimized to your infrastructure, right? I mean, that's yes. the reason to do it is because your goal is to create the best experience on AWS. You know, that's yep. what you want. And yeah. Gentlemen, I'm going to interrupt for one moment for this very important message.
Hey, Richard.
Yeah, buddy.
You know, Raygun is sponsoring this portion of .NET Rocks, and who better to talk about Raygun than Raygun, JD Trask. Welcome for a few seconds.
Awesome. Hi.
Howdy, guys.
Hey. JD, I've read your stuff, and you talk a lot about that sort of customer-centric mindset, that you can use logging to really understand that your customers are happy or not happy, whether they tell you directly or not. Talk more about that, because I think being really customer-centered today is super important.
Yeah, it's absolutely critical in today's business. And, you know, there's a lot been written about this with, say, for example, what Amazon's done trying to be the most customer-centric business. You know, people are putting the customer first. And that applies as much in software. Even at the mm-hmm. end of the day, when we're talking about things like IoT and whatnot, ultimately, why do we build software? We build it for human beings, right? Mm-hmm. If we don't think about the user, the person who's on the receiving end of our software, we are missing the primary stakeholder in it. You know, yeah. it's not actually our employer. It's not really even us as a coder. It's the customer. And so making sure that they are the center of how you think about these things is really important. So I'll give you one small concrete example. We do obviously track errors with one of our products, and we will also track how many unique users have been impacted by that error. Now, that's not identifying wow. data. It's just a GUID that we do a distinct count on. But that way you could say, if I had 10,000 errors that affected 10,000 customers, or I had 10,000 errors that was one customer stuck in a loop, right? Helping you prioritize and sort and manage that for maximum customer impact is something that I think is missing from a lot of these sort of ops tools and whatnot, where you're just keeping an eye on stuff. And you might be fixing something just because the graph is wrong, not because a customer was having a bad experience. I think that's something that we need to continue to evolve and push on as an industry.
Boy, you got that right, man. It's like a bunch of chefs sitting around a pot of soup and not being able to taste it and saying, I think it needs more of this. No, it needs more of that. Right?
That is an awesome analogy I'm going to steal, Carl. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. You know, anything to do with food, that's right up my alley.
That's where you go.
And if you want to know more about Raygun, go to raygun.com and click on Start Your Free Trial.
And we're back. It's .NET Rocks. I'm Richard Campbell. That's Carl Franklin.
Hey.
Talking to our friend Isaac Levin, who is working for AWS these days, and certainly speaks the language of .NET, and I appreciate him taking all these things on.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't want to walk away from this app migration story. I've grabbed all the links, and now I'm trying to figure out a sequence of events for the 4.8 app in that scenario. Sure. Got to get off the home hardware, mm-hmm. got to get into the cloud. And I'm going to make the jump to say also, and I know if I just land this in a VM, my boss isn't going to be happy, because that is a kind of an expensive way to go, both from a monthly cost from the provider and also from an operations cost. Yep. They need care and feeding, right?
Yep.
So I now look at app to container. Is that a logical path?
So I think one of the things that's really important to call out is, like, what is the level of effort you want to make, and what is the, I guess, what you're looking to accomplish, right? So let's just take the story of I'm on 4.8 and I can't get to .NET 6.
Yeah, there's no plan to move the platform just yet.
Yeah, I do have a web forms app, and it's going to be way too complicated to build a Blazor app that mimics that. Or maybe WCF to WCF Core doesn't work for me for a particular reason. Or WCF to gRPC isn't a good option, right? Mm-hmm. But I want to take advantage of cloud capabilities. So I have two options in that vein. I could use AWS App to Container, which, like I mentioned, is that command line based tool that, like, analyzes your application and basically sets you up in a position where you can deploy to container based services in AWS. So that's one option.
I'm expecting, like you asked, like, how much effort do you want to make? It's always the least amount possible.
Oh, sure. I mean,
But at the same time, what I'm excited about a tool like this is I don't know a lot about containers. So if this tool keeps helping me avoid the pitfalls, right? It's like, yes. Tell me where the dragons are. And along the way, I'm going to start learning about the architecture of containers. Like, I think the big one in my learning was just understanding how important it is to get state out of the instance.
Yes.
And we're kind of sloppy with that in .NET. Like, you can build an awful lot of apps for a long way in your own Windows machines. And I've even done this. I called that app stateless. Then I stuck it in a container, found out it had a bunch of state.
Yeah.
You know, surprise.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I mean, especially in .NET framework land, right? Like, state is just there. And
yep.
No matter how hard you try to remove it, it's always probably going to be there in some capacity, right? Because of the concepts that we were using building web forms, for instance, that's like a canonical example,
yep.
Right? Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's a little bit of awareness, a little bit of education and enablement, right? So I understand as a .NET developer, if I've been in .NET framework land for a long time, like, I might not know anything about containers. So if I can have a tool that walks me through the process of, okay, your application, it's Windows-based, so it needs a Windows-based container. You're doing these particular things. And at the end of the day, it's going to set you up in a better position. Even though Windows container sizes are larger than, say, Linux-based containers just because of image sizes, it's still more cost-effective than a VM, right? I think that's I think people even that might not be aware about all the intricacies of containers know that it's cheaper than a VM, right?
Yep.
Or at least have heard that it's cheaper. So I think that's one of the big things. Also, like, I don't like using the phrase best practices, but it definitely puts you in a position where you're making, I guess you could say, accurate choices or mm-hmm. best case scenario choices to get from where you are to where you want to be. So that's like, I guess in my opinion, that's probably the least invasive process, because it's just taking an app and making it a container, right? There's that next step where you understand, okay, I have this app, maybe there's 40 endpoints on it,
right?
Like the quote unquote monolith story, right? And maybe I don't want to make a change to my shopping cart and then I literally have to deploy every other feature or every other service that exists.
Yeah, the great ball of goo problem.
Right. So, and that's where the microservice extractor for .NET comes in, because what it'll do is it'll look through your project. It will identify all the components that can be grouped together to be more microservice based. Mm-hmm. And then it will actually extract those services out into different services. And then it kind of goes through that same process of containerizing them. So then that can go into, you know, Elastic Kubernetes service, nice. For instance.
You know, I was thinking about that. That might be a good place to start, but do we really want a tool sort of defining our domain? You know?
Well, it's not completely, what's the best way? It's not going to force you down a particular path. But if you're in this position where I need help,
yeah.
It's a tool for help.
It might be a good place to start. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I'm very clear, like, none of these tools are magic bullets, right? Mm. Like, you do have to work.
It's not an easy button.
Yeah. But so that's like in .NET framework world, right? In the situation, there is another tool like we're just talking about if I want to get from framework 4.8 or framework 3.5 or whatever version my framework is, and I want to modernize it to .NET 6. And it's an MVC app, for instance, or it's a WCF app and I want to move it to WCF core or whatever, or maybe some class libraries, for instance. You can then go down this path of porting it. So using the porting assistant. And that's like there's a standalone executable, like an actual GUI environment or GUI application, or it's a Visual Studio extension. And
you got Dave Aykroyd in the chat excited. He goes, how much does it cost?
So for porting assistant, all the code is available on GitHub. Mm-hmm. So like I said, it's an open source tool. You can install it. The extension is a free tool. The one caveat being today is that you need an AWS account because there is some telemetry collection as a part of that. We're looking at options for that to not be the case, where we, you know, just at the end of the day, we want people to be able to use these tools without being tied into AWS. But we do want to get an understanding of tool usage.
Yeah.
So we're kind of balancing out that. But it isn't one of those things where you have to write me a check if you want to use these tools. I think at the end of the day, it's about getting you to AWS,
right?
And if we're going to add something in the front that charges you money to use it, like that's not advantageous for us.
And it's not your business either, right? You're not a consulting service for modifying apps. There are companies out there that'll do that. And actually, they do have tools they charge for and typically offer for on your behalf. You guys are a cloud provider, and these are tools to help people get to the cloud. So, you know, thanks for that.
Yeah.
Let's talk about fully managed container services versus managed Kubernetes services. Because how many container solutions do I need?
Well, I think it really depends on, you know, back to the comment earlier about like, what are you trying to accomplish?
Yeah.
Right. Like, I'll be the first one to say, like, Kubernetes is something that I've tried to learn about 4,000 times. And so
it doesn't stick. It's like regex.
I blame YAML.
Well, yeah. So at least from my perspective, containerization is a bit more approachable for me because I understand the underlying concepts. But when it comes to different services that exist, that are quote unquote container based, it's about what you're trying to accomplish and how much you're willing to, I guess, abstract out that level of hosting. Mm-hmm. So for instance, we have Elastic Container Service, which is our canonical container service for AWS. We also have something that's called Fargate, which is serverless container running, right?
Okay.
So that's like that next step of like, hey, I have an app, but it doesn't need to be on all the time. I want to be able to save a little bit of cost in that space. And then finally, you have the Kubernetes option, which, you know, gives you full autonomous control of all these different things, being able to manage service discovery and secret management and all those sort of things inside of that Kubernetes environment that you might be familiar with from somewhere else.
Yeah. I mean, I think the strength of Kubernetes is that it has an ecosystem around it. And so you're finding more people that are experienced with it. But I think for the most part, folks don't care, right? That for an awful lot of apps, just running into container servers should be sufficient. I don't want to need to learn this. I want it to just work. Although I would make that argument then, it's like, why think about the container service at all? Why not? Well, I guess you get the container service first and then maybe just start, as I start tuning and tweaking stuff, I'm going to make it into serverless things.
Yeah, I think so. And that's something that I'd like to talk about a little bit as well. Like the whole serverless idea, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
and you mentioned Fargate.
Fargate is serverless containers.
Okay.
But there's also AWS Lambda, which if you're a developer in general, you've at least heard of AWS Lambda.
Sure. Right? Well, they are the original, right?
Yeah.
Like this is
original serverless functions.
Yeah.
And I think when we talked to Rob Shever, he's talking about it, like almost built against the will of Amazon. Like, I don't know that leadership understood the mindset. Mm.
Sure. And now, like, you know, if you build like a Amazon Alexa app, for instance, right, as the device in my office just lit up.
Don't say the E word.
No. Yeah. If you're building skills for that platform, like, you have an option to have a Lambda service that calls into, right? So like when you're going through the Alexa skill process, it just says, do you want to point this at a Lambda function? And you just do that, right? So I think, at least from my perspective, a .NET developer that has a chunk of code that they want to run based on some particular event, like, look at Lambda almost immediately, right? If you don't need a UI, if you have an application or a set of or a chunk of code that needs to run on particular use case, some like a file gets dropped into a file store or an S3,
right?
Database update, like, yeah, trigger, right? Triggers and or even HTTP or scheduled job, right?
Yep.
But I think that is the option in most cases that we're building as developers. If we don't have a UI, we have something that's being triggered by some event.
But it's the least amount of plumbing, right? It's like, this is just a piece of code I want to run. Charge me for that. The trade of that is then I end up with a few hundred of them, and now how the heck do I manage them?
Sure. I think you're going to have that problem regardless, though, right?
Oh, sure. It's just, I can fool myself in one case. You're not letting me fool myself in the other case, Isaac.
Yeah, sure. If you're building an app and you realize these are all the components that I need for my app, like, you know, this is an architectural decision that needs to be consistently happening through the story, right? Like, hey, maybe I, you know, to use the canonical e-commerce example, right? Like, oh, I have a shopping cart and I have a checkout function. Maybe I have some user login process, and maybe I have a shipping notifier and all these other things, right? Yeah, you could have literally like individual serverless functions for all those different things.
Right.
And then you have like some state store, like a database or whatever, or other data source. You could do that. Then you could go down the container route if you want to, if you want to have a lot of shared functionality between them. Mm. And then finally, like, oh, okay, well, at some point in time, at least in my view, I have too many of these services that are running as containers. Right. And they all are chatty and they're all talking back and forth. That's where something where Kubernetes comes in very well, because it allows you to have that communication that has a little bit less latency, right? Hmm. And that's one of the benefits to Kubernetes. Like, again, I'm not a Kubernetes expert. Somebody probably in the chat is like, that's an incorrect statement about Kubernetes. But I think in general, like, it's as your application needs grow, you probably will grow out of some services. Right. And that's where the real challenge becomes. Like, how do I get from Lambda to EKS?
Mm, right.
Right.
Or from managed container to managed Kubernetes.
Exactly. Mm. Right. Like, I think that's where things become really, really interesting. Mm-hmm. And again, like, there's professional services that can help you. There's lots of documentation on these sort of things. But at the end of the day, it's what do you need to do?
Right.
Because we can all attest, like, there's nothing that is just magic for us. There's no one button click this service to this service, or, you know, this framework to this framework or whatever.
But I would hope that the path from ECS to EKS is pretty painless. I suspect it's Kubernetes under the hood anyway. You're just hiding from in ECS.
Yeah. So with ECS in particular, it's actually not Kubernetes under the hood.
Oh, okay.
They're managed EC2 instances. So EC2 being the virtual machine provider.
Right.
And the orchestration is all done by the ECS management system.
Right.
Kubernetes obviously is Kubernetes.
It's Kubernetes.
So, yeah. So one of the things that's interesting to say about going from ECS to Kubernetes is, they use the same canonical, I guess, configuration steps, right?
Right.
Like, they use container images, they use YAML files, they use some constructors of sorts, right? So the porting story, even though it's different under the hood lying infrastructure, the process to get your application from there to there is very similar.
Mm. Yeah, the architecture is kind of the same, right? It's not that different. Yeah. So you just got to hop through some hoops on that. And again, I hope there's some good tooling around that. I'm sure there's things you can do in ECS that are hard to port to EKS. Just
like anything, right?
Yeah, for sure. If you got deeply enough into it, got to the edges of it, you know, you're going to find those problems. And I understand, and I presume, but certainly it's true in Azure. I suspect it's true, is that Lambdas are actually running in containers. You just don't see the container. You're just running Lambdas. Mm.
So at the end of the day, like, especially if you get all the way to that serverless story, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, whether it's serverless containers with Fargate, or serverless blocks of code, or even like if you even go farther down the path of like the pro code or low code solutions, right? Like step functions or something like that. There's this point in time where I just don't care. It could be running on top of an elephant for all I care, right? Like, and it doesn't matter, because as long as my code runs, and it runs effectively, and it's not slow.
Mm, good enough.
And it scales well, good enough for me, right?
Yeah. But that's always the problem, is when it is slow, now what? I mean, the best thing about being on a cloud provider is when it's slow, it's somebody else's fault.
Right? Sure.
Like that's we blame the provider every time.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you can just throw money at the problem and then make it fast.
And in some respects, you really can. And then they're like, maybe we don't mind slow because that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, surprise. But I think always the concern for anyone is this 80% case. I got down to this certain point, and then the prices just skyrocketed. Now my boss is mad at me again, right? We haven't quite gotten all the way up. And then what decision do we make in the end? And you sort of gave this implication here, Isaac, that like serverless is the ultimate end game. And I'm just sort of questioning, like, is that really true? Like, if you're really going to go for this, you should be building serverless for everything?
No, I think it really depends on the kind of app you're building, right? I think serverless is very advantageous for certain workloads, and for other workloads, it's a terrible, terrible, terrible idea, right?
Can you provide examples of a terrible serverless solution?
Yeah. For instance, if you have an application that is all like a quote unquote always on
state,
right? Mm-hmm. Like you don't, it needs state, it's not spiky as it pertains to traffic.
Right.
Like these are things that you need some service that isn't going to give you some cold start problem, going to give you some, oh, I need to manage state completely outside of the application somewhere else that's going to add even more latency to the story. Right. So, you know, I think one of the examples that I always hear for serverless, for instance, is like e-commerce, right? Like, oh, I'm adding something to a shopping cart or whatever. And I think even at that point, at scale, becomes very problematic, right?
Well, and you talk about an always-on service. Like the success of an e-commerce site is measured in transactions per second.
Yes.
That's pretty always-on.
Yeah. I've just always heard, like, and I think you have the opportunity in some of these cases where you have serverless, but it's always warm.
Right.
Right? So, because it's all about the abstraction of things, right? Like at some particular point in time, whether you're using a managed version of IIS, for instance, or you're using a completely managed code environment that you just run some section of code on, at the end of the day, you have to make a decision of what is the cost of having this service always on versus this service always on. And sometimes the pricing is very similar. Sometimes, in probably most cases, it's not at all.
Yeah.
Right.
No, and I see the serverless approach as irregular workloads that they're with periods of no operation at all. So, because unused serverless costs nothing. It has a little bit of warm up time, so you need to be tolerant to that, but it spikes really well.
You know what I wouldn't recommend? SQL Server serverless in Azure. Ask me how I know.
Yeah.
Not only was it never, not only did you have to wait 10 seconds for a query when it was off, but it was very expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah. I found out the hard way.
Expensive and slow.
Yeah. Okay. Hey, it's expensive, but at least it's slow.
Yeah, but at least it's slow. But it is, again, you get into this whole shape of workload problem that what is the behavior of the workload? What makes sense?
Yeah. Like for instance, like, I mean, the idea of having a data source or a database that's serverless, right? Like in AWS world, we have Amazon Aurora, which is MySQL or Postgres style databases, but you can have a server, you can run it serverless. You can run it serverless as well.
Right.
And, you know, again, back to the conversation of like, what is your tolerance, right? There is going to be some form of latency or some form of slowness on that initial query or that initial configuration because you're not paying for it when it's not being used. Right.
Right.
And, you know, there's always going to be a trade-off. 10 seconds in your particular case is that's rough. That's really rough. But I think at the end of the day, there's probably some, obviously if you probably skew up, you probably, that 10 seconds probably goes down substantially. Right.
Yeah.
That's just how it works too.
And I've talked to folks who, you know, started out with, well, this is only being used during the workday, in an 8-hour day. So I'm going to use serverless because it's off for 16 hours. But during that 8 hours, they rack up a huge bill. And it's like, turned out it was easier to set up a startable VM and just an hour before it's likely to be used, warm it up, run it for the 8 hours and wind it back down again.
Sure.
You know, if you're going to take responsibility for that. So it is interesting to think that. What I really appreciate about this is you can't be a developer or an architect and not think about operations when you're in the cloud. Operations matter. The shape of this app's execution matters. And you have to, you know, if you talk about tendency towards DevOps, it's like, I got to sit with operations folks and we got to work through this. What do we understand about the workload? How can we break it out? Like, I think that the other part of serverless is great is that microservice problem that, hey, here's this difficult piece of the app that often has a real spiky demand and getting it away from the rest of the instances of the app, making it into a serverless component just meant it only hurt itself. Like it didn't hurt everything else. Like we got really angry when it's like this one small set of classes in this large group of services required us to propagate across many more servers just to serve that piece. But when we hauled it out and made it serverless, that went away.
Yeah, and that's, and this is even kind of like the second or third conversation in the story, right? Like, mm-hmm. There's also this story of like, okay, I'm choosing, I want to build a .NET app on AWS. What tools do I have locally that are going to set me up for success, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Even outside of the whole, you know, am I deploying to ECS or Elastic Beanstalk or EKS or Lambdas or whatever? Like, what tools do I have that can actually help me get there?
Right. I want to employ it at Elastic Beanstalk because I love the name.
It is quite an awesome name, isn't it? And you know what's great about that is that, you know, you have these boring tech meetings and people, and all of a sudden somebody says Elastic Beanstalk and everybody goes, what?
Yeah. The one thing that I will say is that the Elastic concept is fun. Yeah. The Beanstalk thing is fun. But I think all the AWS services, like, they have, like, there are fun-ish names. Like, you know, and, you know, we could be boring and just call it what exactly it is. But I think there's also some fun about like, oh, you know, do you remember like when you would build new servers, like you would call, like after you would, after superhero characters or, you know, Star Trek ships.
No. All my servers are still South Park characters to this
exactly,
day.
Right? Yeah. There's something fun in that, right? So being able to give it a service that you're creating that's going to be used by potentially millions of developers, giving it a name that's going to be memorable is kind of cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, no. My beta test server is called Kenny because I kill it all the time.
That's great.
Sure. That's pretty good.
That's awesome.
But yeah, the...
You should see the messages in the log when I do.
Yeah, I think one of the things, too, is, you know, going back to services specifically.
Yeah.
You know, depending on what service you use, there you might need different tooling too, right?
Yeah.
Like for instance, if you're building Lambda, a Lambda function for AWS and .NET, like we supply a ton of development level tools. Like, you know, we have these AWS .NET Lambda tools, right? Which help you orchestrate the process of building applications, right? Even to the effect that like command line based utilities to deploy AWS Lambda. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the IDE and the command line story is really, really important as well. So, you know, for folks that might not know, AWS has IDEs for Visual Studio, Visual Studio Code, and Writer, right? So if you're building .NET applications, regardless of, you know, your flavor or your religion as it pertains to IDE, we have like an extension for you.
Nice.
And those extensions allow deployment. They also allow resource management inside the box as well, which is pretty cool.
Very cool.
I love all these different services, Isaac, and I'm going to paraphrase one of Dave Aykroyd's questions from the chat here, which is, does Amazon have a discoverability problem? Like, how do you find out about all these services?
I mean, especially in the .NET space, mm-hmm. you know, we're because that's where my primary focus is, right?
Yeah.
Like, I think there's tons of opportunity to raise awareness. Hence mm-hmm. why I'm talking to you lovely folks.
I know. And I'm happy to have you for exactly that reason.
Is there an AWS Rocks podcast?
I mean, Carl, what are you doing tomorrow?
Not that. I'll tell you what. Not that.
But I think I don't want to say it as much as there's an awareness problem, but I think that there's always opportunity to give folks options, right? Yeah. If I'm a .NET developer and I'm looking to go to the cloud, I might only think I have one option. And we all know that's not 100% true.
Right.
But unless there's really, really good docs, really, really good content out there, and people that are talking about it in a public way, I'm not going to think about it as much.
And give me a blog post, a how-to blog post that doesn't involve 17 different steps.
Sure. Well, that's one of the things that I'm doing too. So like, you know, just full disclosure, like so at the time of this recording, I'm 2 months into my job at AWS. Mm-hmm. Right. I have a little bit of AWS experience previously, but nowhere near at the level that, you know, most customers expect from somebody who's building .NET apps on AWS. Right?
Right.
So I'm going through my learning process, right? Like I have a YouTube series called AWS for the .NET Developer, where every week I'm posting a short video about, hey, this is a cool thing that I'm learning on AWS today. Mm-hmm. Right. And I want people to follow along with me on my journey. And we're looking at live stream options too and other forms of content. But like, you know, getting the AWS name out there when we're talking to .NET developers is really, really important, right? And that's one of my core areas. So like, I think, you know, whether it's accessibility to the tooling. So knowing that, like, some of the modernization tools we were talking about earlier, knowing they even exist.
Right.
Because if I go to a conference and I say, hey, have you seen this before? And nobody raises their hand, womp, womp, right?
Yeah. Yep.
Like, you know, being able to make people aware of those because they are helpful.
You know, I joked about the podcast, but, you know, PWOP Studios does podcast production. So if you want to do your own AWS Rocks podcast and you need some editing and publishing help, you can come to me. I would be happy to do that.
Well, I appreciate that for a nominal fee.
Yeah, of course.
I don't know how nominal that actually is.
Yeah.
Where do people go for more? Mm.
Yeah, I think, you know, the best place that you can definitely go is aws.amazon.com/developer/language/.net. Mm-hmm. I need to get a short version of that. But if you use your favorite browser and search .NET and AWS, you're going to go to our go-to-market page, which shows all of the things we've talked about, shows the different services that exist, a lot of how-tos, a lot of great content specifically tied to .NET on AWS.
Awesome.
Right? And, you know, we're trying to build this community of awareness, right? So, you know, there's a .NET on AWS Twitter handle. Please take a look at that. You know, we're also doing some things in the open source space, right? AWS is a sponsor of the .NET Foundation, which I'm the chair of the marketing committee for. Like, I think at the end of the day, just making folks aware that AWS, you can live happily on AWS as a .NET developer. That's the call to action that I'd like to call.
That's great. Absolutely. Isaac Levin, thank you very much for enlightening us today. And if you haven't checked out AWS lately, go do it. Thanks again.
No problem. Thank you. Take care.
All right. We'll see you next time on .NET Rocks.
.NET Rocks is brought to you by Franklin's Net and produced by PWOP Studios, a full-service audio, video, and post-production facility located physically in New London, Connecticut, and of course in the cloud. Online at pwop.com. Visit our website at dotnetrocks.com for RSS feeds, downloads, mobile apps, comments, and access to the full archives going back to show number one, recorded in September 2002. And make sure you check out our sponsors. They keep us in business. Now go write some code. See you next time.